She saw again, after all those years, the bright Narnian stars. She had once known them better than the stars of our own world, because as a queen in Narnia, she had gone to bed much later than as a child in England. And there they were. At least three of the summer constellations could be seen from where she lay. The ship, the hammer, and the leopard. Dear old leopard.
You know where we left off?
I don't remember. I was actually going to ask if you had time to look at
it. It was just after Trumpkin, basically, you know, Trumpkin's told his whole story, and now we finally connected it back to the Pevensies, and we know that, okay, that's the reason the horn was blown, that's the reason Trumpkin was sent. So basically Trumpkin just finished his story. You're pardoned for forgetting, since it was, what, three,
pre-marriage.
4 months ago?
That's all that matters.
A lot's been happening to Rillian. Basically, chapter 8, how they left the island. So then they have to go through the sword fighting, the shooting match, and the whole cordial thing before Trumpkin is actually convinced, before he really accepts them.
You know, that part of the book, I think, shows the idea of the Narnian heir.
Uh-huh.
You know, after spending more time in Narnia, they may not be the same age that they were, but they're sort of in the same condition. They're back to it's like their old wisdom, muscle memory, kind of maturity in some ways as well, mannerisms almost. It's something that the book sort of does a good job explaining, like, you know, now they can actually fight in battle, whereas a few hours ago they couldn't have.
It's not like, oh, there's something magical about the heir of Narnia. You know, it's just super healing powers of the heir of Narnia. It's more that it's reminding them of who they used to be.
Yeah.
And so just emotionally, spiritually, they're slowly becoming the kings and queens they used to be. I love when Edmund and Trumpkin are fighting, and it talks about Edmund. It's an exciting scene. I love the way Lewis describes it. Really high energy, the way he describes the sword fight. But my favorite part is when he talks about Edmund. The heir of Narnia was working on him, and his fingers remembered, you know, their old strength. He was King Edmund once again.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that it doesn't come across as a, oh, well, Lewis just said this so that, you know, it allowed him to, you know, make it more believable. It actually makes the characters a little more endearing, too, in some ways, because it's like, oh, okay, I can accept they really are children,
right?
You know, in our world, and I can accept, at the same time, they really are kings and queens.
There's a little great, Lewis finds places to squeeze in little funny moments like this, like when they're, just before the shooting match, they flip a coin. Mm-hmm. And it says, you know, greatly to the interest of, I can't remember the exact words, like, greatly to the interest of Trumpkin, who had never seen a coin flip before.
Yeah.
And it's just, he finds little tiny character things like that, that they're small, but they just, it makes it funnier, but mm-hmm. also kind of more real. Like, the fact that he would even bother to mention something like that.
And even things like, you have things like the DLF, you know, where Edmund says, you know, Peter says, the DLF had better steer. You can kind of grasp the humor of your own day, and, oh yeah, that would be kind of funny to see a coin flip. And at the same time, you're in this other story. And it's kind of a both and that
right.
It's kind of delicate to do, but I think he accomplishes it well.
Right. And so we get going, start going down Glasswater Creek, and I really love the moment, and it's just something that was, they kind of half-heartedly tried to do in the movie, and they probably did about the best they could, but when Lucy sees the stars, kind of the same thing when Edmund is fighting Trumpkin, and it says that, you know, his fingers remembered their old strength, and just the feeling of, oh, it's so nice to be back. That's the feeling for the Pevensies, and then for Narnia, it would be so nice to go back, you know, that longing for things to be the way they used to be is so central to the story.
Because some of those things you might not even take for granted, like actually, I'm hardly an astronomer, and I actually kind of like to take little night scenes from, say, different fantasy movies and just see if that is actually our sky or if they did just digitally scramble it, you know, just a little bit.
It makes it seem real, because I wouldn't think a typical writer would think of something like that, but if this really did happen, that would definitely be something that you would notice, I think, that, or at least someone like Lucy would notice in that world.
Yeah, and it, at the same time, it's sort of a, ah, yes, but at least this hasn't changed, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's like kind of what the treasure chamber scene does, I think. It's like stepping back in time for a second.
Ah, yes, but at least the sword hasn't rusted, you know.
Right.
Well, you know, as the story continues, we have, you know, chapter 9, what Lucy saw. And Prince Caspian, pretty much any fan would know exactly what that chapter is about.
Mm-hmm.
This part of the story here, I'll never forget it, because in the book, of course, I think maybe I wondered if Lucy was even right, but at the same time, I think I always knew, no, Lucy's right. Peter and the others are wrong.
That's a great question. Like, do you know? Like, I'm always curious to see how many people just completely believe Lucy and how many aren't sure at first. Because the book never says, and then Lucy saw Aslan. The book's just, all of a sudden, Lucy, it's completely out of nowhere, out of the blue. Oh, it's the lion, Aslan himself.
And then that's where the choice comes in. And you know, it's a matter of the others not believing her. Same question that you had in the line, The Witch, the Wardrobe. Is she delusional? You know, is she lying? Or is she telling the truth?
Now, of course, the difference, of course, is that in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we see everything from Lucy's point of view, so we know that she's telling the truth, whereas here, we're in the position of the other kids in Trumpkin.
Yeah, we have to make the judgment, too.
Right.
We have to make a decision as a reader.
Now, I definitely was inclined to believe Lucy, but there was a little bit of doubt, just because I thought it was strange that...
Well, why didn't he show himself to the others, you know?
Right, and that's really weird. And the fact that it doesn't say, and Lucy saw Aslan, it's just her claim. And the timing of it coming, it catches you off guard. And
yeah.
It's another way, that's kind of what the bear attack did for the story, I think. You know, there's a lot of walking and talking, and it just, whoa, makes you sit up a bit. This is just so out of the blue. And the timing is, it's really bad for Lucy, because Trumpkin has just outlined a plan that makes a lot of sense. We're going downstream, and it's the most hopeful part of the journey, where it's like, well, I think we're probably going to get to Caspian, and Aslan chooses that moment to appear. Like, no, the opposite direction.
Yeah.
I completely understand why the others are doubtful, just because it's so inconvenient. It would be so inconvenient at this point to believe Lucy. Lucy hasn't really done much on the journey at this point. She, you know, when she asked Peter if she could row, he said, no, the oars are too big for you. And, you know, later Susan points out, you know, it's 4-1 and you're the youngest.
I've always remembered when Edmund, you know, tells them, I was reading the vote, he says, when we first discovered Narnia a year ago, or 1,000 years ago, whichever it is, it was Lucy who discovered it first and none of us believed her. I was the worst of the lot, I know. Yet she was right. Wouldn't it be fair to believe her this time? I vote for going up.
Great character moment.
That sort of, when I saw that, I thought, I guess it really was Aslan. You know, we just, I don't know why I thought that, but I just thought, huh, that must have really been Aslan. Because it does, you know, I was just looking at the text here, and it does just come out of nowhere.
Yeah, let me just read it real quick here. The moment Trumpkin is talking about his plan, what do you think they should do about going downstream? Trumpkin, you are a brick, said Peter. Come on then, down this side of the gorge. Look, 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 cried Lucy. Where? What? Asked everyone. The lion, said Lucy. Aslan himself, didn't you see? Her face had changed completely, and her eyes shone. So it really does come totally out of nowhere.
And it's also a kind of a sad scene, because you have this feeling of missing out, you know, as they go on. And you just kind of wonder, oh, I wonder what they're missing out on, you know?
All right, so they choose to go downstream, and they run into an outpost and, you know, have to dodge some arrows. And then that night... Lucy sees something else, or she experiences something else, and this is obviously one of the real memorable iconic scenes in the series, when she finally really does meet Aslan. You know, earlier in the story, she woke up and thought the trees were coming to life, and then they didn't quite come to life, and it's so frustrating, and it's, you know, it's so sad, and here they really do finally start coming to life. And then I love when she sees Aslan, she's running towards him, and Lewis writes, she felt her heart would burst if she lost a moment. Her longing for Aslan, her longing for the old days to return, just... kind of overwhelms everything. That's what makes, to me, Lucy just such a great character.
Yeah. And I love, of course, you have one of the most famous lines.
There's a lot of famous scenes in this part of the book.
It is, and it's a really beautiful scene, just the idea, and it's really one of the most truthful lines about Aslan, where, you know, he says, welcome, child, he said. Aslan, said Lucy, you're bigger. That is because you're older, little one, answered he. Not because you are. I am not. For every year you grow, you will find me bigger. And for that to be true, for Lucy's view of Aslan to change based on how she's grown, then it means that Aslan is obviously bigger than even the reader is seeing here. You know, he's not constrained to the form of a lion.
It gives him a lot of depth, just that idea, and how mysterious that idea is. And so, like, the sense you get reading it in the book is that it's not so much Aslan's changing, it's Lucy's perception of Aslan that's changing. And the problem with the movie line...
I've missed you so much. You've grown.
Every year you grow, so shall I.
That's really weird that for some reason, Aslan and Lucy have this bizarre connection where as she grows, as she physically grows, he physically grows too. That's a really weird idea. And you get the sense that they put that in the movie because they knew it was important and it was so memorable, but they didn't really understand what it was about.
No. But you also have a very interesting concept here. You know, the one Aslan reprimands first, the first one he reprimands is Lucy. And it really, it kind of took me back as a reader because I thought, why is he mad at Lucy? You know, she was the one who told the
others.
That's
true.
And, you know, but then she was the one who'd been given the most. He didn't appear to the others for whatever reason. He expected or demanded the most of Lucy.
Yeah, you know, Lucy's saying, you know, like, you know, it wasn't my fault. You know, they wouldn't believe me. They're also, and he starts to kind of, she's going to criticize them. And then Lewis writes, from somewhere deep inside Aslan's body, there came the faintest suggestion of a growl, which is a pretty scary moment. Can you imagine you're in a lion's arms and it starts growling? That'd be a really scary moment. He's not really saying anything, but you get the sense that he's sort of disappointed in her. There's a couple lines here that clearly the filmmakers didn't understand. One of them is, now you are a lioness. Aslan tells her, you know, you've got to go wake up the others. You got to go do something really uncomfortable right now and wake up the others and say, Aslan's here. And it takes Lucy a while to kind of get the strength to do this. And finally she says, I'm sorry, Aslan. She said, I'm ready now. Now you are a lioness, said Aslan. First off, what's kind of your interpretation of that line? What does that mean when Aslan tells Lucy, now you are a lioness? Because I'm not entirely sure.
I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching a bit here.
Do it.
I just think about, you know, when was the last time Aslan went and did something that he really would have preferred he not have to do?
Stone table.
Lucy's going against what she would prefer to do because she knows it's the right thing. And she has, I think Aslan's saying, the heart of a lioness. Lucy gets the name Queen Lucy the Valiant. And at one point you think, you know, she's the smallest, she's the youngest, she's the littlest, and yet she's the one who gets the name, the title Valiant. And I think it suits her here. You know, I think the movie sort of cheapened it.
And you'll help?
Of course. As will you.
Oh, I wish I was braver.
If you were any braver, you'd be a lioness.
Right, so he's not saying you are a lioness, like, well, you would be a lioness. And I really just think the filmmakers didn't really know what the line meant. So they thought, that's really weird. What does it mean? Which is kind of the point of the line. It's intriguing. And I'll tell you, I don't know what it means. I don't know what Lewis intended. But the way I take it is you have to look at the context of the scene. I think when Aslan was kind of scolding her a bit for not coming initially, and he growls, I think Aslan was sort of hurt. By the fact that she didn't come. And now she's saying, okay, I'm ready now. Just before he says the line, he's responding to Lucy saying, I'm ready now. So it's like, okay, Aslan, I'm on the same page as you. I'm going to go do something really uncomfortable, and I'm just going to take your word for it.
And she says, and the book says, it is a terrible thing to have to wake four people, all older than yourself and all very tired, for the purpose of telling them something they probably won't believe and making them do something they certainly won't like.
Why is it that, why do you think Aslan does this? And I don't know the answer to this. I've read this book several times. It's just one of those things I don't understand, and I'm kind of okay with not understanding it. But why is Aslan invisible to them? And it seems initially you kind of think, oh, it's because they don't believe Lucy and because they're so focused on, no, we're going to get this done. But the problem is even Edmund, who buys into what Lucy's saying, why does it take even him so long? After a while, he's like, oh, he sees, oh, there's his shadow. I guess, well, where is he? You know, why would it take Edmund so long? I mean, we can only kind of speculate, I guess. But what do you think Aslan's idea is here with being invisible to them? And why does he slowly become visible to them one by one?
I'll admit it's speculation. I think if Lewis were going to make it clear in the book, I think it would be really clear. I'll address the second part of the question first. Why is it that it takes him so long to see him? If it were a matter of just, well, it's where they are, their own personal faith that he's really there. If that's what allowed them to see, why didn't Lucy keep seeing him early on? It wasn't say, oh, well, he was here, so therefore he could see better. No, I think it was Aslan deciding to show, say, Edmund. It wasn't that Edmund had more ability based on where he was and his belief. I think it was Aslan choosing. And as for the first part of the question, why was it that Aslan did it this way? I don't think we can really say, I don't think we're supposed to be able to know or even really have that much of an educated guess as to why. I think we can say what it does. It allows for them to rise to a higher standard. Lucy would not have to demonstrate the same amount of bravery without that. The others, you know, Trumpkin, Susan, Edmund, Peter, they would not have to demonstrate the same kind of faith in Lucy And actually, in Aslan as well.
And you certainly see an attitude change, like when Peter finally meets Caspian and says, you know, we don't know where Aslan is, and we don't know when he's going to act, you know, but he'll be in his time, no doubt, not ours. He's kind of okay with that. And so Peter, as a result of that, Peter immediately starts making better decisions. But then also, when Aslan's talking to Susan, who was the last person to see him, probably, either Susan or Trumpkin was the last person to see him, and Lewis writes, then, after an awful pause, the deep voice said, Susan. Susan made no answer, but the others thought she was crying. You have listened to your fears, child, said Aslan. Come, let me breathe on you. Forget them. Are you brave again? A little, Aslan, said Susan. So it's obvious that there was something, I think Aslan, where even though Peter, it took him a while to see him, Aslan still says, my dear son, like he's, you know, pleased with him. Susan was the last one, you know, and so I think Aslan's disappointed in her, and so, but the sense of, you know, you've listened to your fears, so Aslan is trying to show Susan something, or trying to change Susan somehow, or do something for her, and it's almost like it didn't quite work, or whatever it was that was supposed to happen didn't quite happen.
And I love, you know, Lewis's understanding and portrayal of fear throughout all the Chronicles. You know, I think about, like, the Dark Island, you know, just the way that controls people because of what they fear, and, you know, all the other ways it plays into these other stories. But I like that line, you've listened to your fears, because it's really true. You know, what else was she really listening to? Anytime the characters really make the wrong decision, it goes back to other things as well, but it also goes back to listening to their fears.
I think Peter kind of listened to his fears as well, because when he votes against Lucy, Peter says, I know Lucy may be right after all, but I can't help it. We have to do, you know, must do one or the other. And I really get the sense there that Peter deep down knows what you and I know, that, you know, I'm sure if you follow what Lucy's saying, it'll somehow turn out okay. And Peter seems to know that, but he's like, but I can't help it. Now, Aslan tells them, you know, we have no time to lose. You three, you sons of Adam and son of Earth, hasten into the mound and deal with what you will find there. And that's all he says. And then that's it. They just, and it says, the dwarf was still speechless, and neither of the boys dared to ask if Aslan would follow them. They just do what he says. And so they're much more, okay, well, Aslan just said it, so I'm going to do it. And at this point in the story, they start making much better decisions, yeah, kind of with that attitude.
And this is where the story kind of splits off.
Yep.
In an interesting way.
So we're going to stay with the girls, and Aslan roars, and a really imaginatively described scene, I think, where it talks about all the, you know, mm-hmm, rabbits poking their heads out of holes, and, you know, men waking up, women, you know, clutching their babies to their breasts, and it's a cool moment where it's like, it's the turning, yeah, point where the old days are finally returning.
And it's sort of more continuous here, because you have the trees awakening, and then the next day, all these characters come back. It's this presence of goodness that, and wholesomeness, I think is a good way to describe it, that they haven't seen in a long, long time.
This whole scene, the romp, you know, with Bacchus and Silenus and all of that, I think it's one of the scenes I think fans are kind of divided on. Basically, I'd say the fans that don't like this scene, they don't like it because it seems so out of place. And the fans that do like it, they like it because it seems so out of place. That's how far Narnia has come from what it used to be, that the way it should be now seems out of place.
The image of Bacchus and so on, they're not just positive images, they're counter images to what's been going on. The whole story is surrounded by this presence of the Telmarines that have a violent presence. The king, Caspian the Ninth, is murdered. You have the lords who were sent off were killed. You have Caspian's attempted assassination. You have all these things that are going on that are violent and dark throughout the whole story. You have Narnians dying and being imprisoned. And
then you get to, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you get this, it's so jolly, it's absurd. It's almost sort of a relief, is how I take it.
Uh-huh.
And I get why it's out of place, and I think that's kind of the point. And I get why it's controversial as well. You know, Michael Flaherty pointed out in that interview about this being one of the tough bits, because, I mean, I'm no expert on Greek mythology or anything, but Bacchus is the god of winemaking, and the reason Silenus would be on a donkey very often is because he was often too drunk to walk. And indeed, Lewis's version does have Silenus on a donkey. You shouldn't have to be like an expert on Greek mythology to enjoy this. You know, what we just talked about with the effect it has of, wow, the old days are returning, that's all you're supposed to get from it. And you can get, you know, no matter what kind of background you have, you can get that. But if you want to look at it deeper, I just think it's interesting at the end that Susan says, I would not have felt safe with Bacchus and all his wild girls if we met them without Aslan. And so I think there's sort of an acknowledgement of that, that, you know, wow, this is, they're all getting drunk. What's happening? And I don't know if they're literally getting drunk, but I can tell you what the spirit of it is, which is the old days are returning. And, you know, in this violent age, like you were talking about, now things are returning to an age of joy. And so to me, like Aslan's, it's almost like Aslan's presence there changes the way you'd look at this. You wouldn't just look at it, oh, they're all getting drunk. There's something about Aslan's presence there that makes you look at it differently.
You look at the situation, it seems absurd. Why would you celebrate before the Telmarines are even defeated? Why on earth would you celebrate? Well, Aslan's coming, and Aslan's presence in Narnia is reason enough to go ahead and start celebrating. It's that simple. And I think that's part of why it seems odd, is because they are celebrating. They're starting the celebration early.
A scene that I think was, you know, I kind of get why they cut it, but it was just missing from the movie. That's one of the things that it wasn't quite Prince Caspian without that scene. But then we go in back to Peter and Edmund and Trumpkin, and we have what is definitely one of my favorite dialogue scenes in the entire series. Like, Nickabrick, like, some of his lines in here are so great. It's so weird seeing someone make an argument that makes so much sense, but we know it's wrong. Like, I almost get pulled into it. Like, wow, that makes a lot of sense. Well, wait a second. That's completely wrong. Like, he makes a compelling case for maybe Aslan really did just die and didn't come back to life. And I go, wow, that makes sense. Wait a second. That's obviously not true.
Yeah, and I remember when I was listening to this as a child, this was – because there are so many points where, you know, I listen to the story as a kid and I just kind of think, oh, that's, you know, that's a neat story. And then, of course, later – and, of course, I got the basic imagery, you know. But then later I read it when I was older and I thought, oh, that's different. I see that on a whole new level now. This was one of those scenes that for some reason I just – it's like I got the double nature of it instantly.
Well, it's not so much that Nickabrick is lying here. I mean, he really is looking at the information he has, and his conclusions make logical sense. But his conclusions are still wrong.
He says, as for the power, do not the stories say that the witch defeated Aslan and bound him and killed him on that very stone which is over there just beyond the light? But they also say that he came to life again, said the badger sharply. Yes, they say, answered Nickabrick. But you'll notice say that we hear pretty little about anything he did afterwards. He just fades out of the story. How do you explain that if he really came to life? Isn't it much more likely that he didn't, and that the stories say nothing more about him because there was nothing more to say?
That makes a lot of sense.
He established the kings and queens, said Caspian. A king who has just won a great battle can usually establish himself without the help of a performing lion.
So, like, Nickabrick's not lying here, but from his perspective, it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, he's wrong, but you can see how, yeah.
It's an understandable conclusion.
It has power behind it.
The only way I can contradict that argument is to say, well, I read the first book and I know that's wrong.
Yeah.
I've often wondered, when they're talking about, you know, is the help going to come? Is the help going to come? It may now even be at the door. Personally, if I was Peter, I'd walk in and say, yep, that's right. I'm at the door and I'm here. Boom. And what's Nickabrick just, what? You know. And we'll never get to know exactly what Nickabrick's reaction would have been because he dies before he can see them. But what did that ever bother you? What do you think about that?
That did kind of bother me because I kind of thought, okay, come on now. That's your cue. Boom.
Now
come on,
Ed's walking right now.
You know, it's like, hey, come on, this is the perfect entrance now, Peter. You know.
They may even now be at the door.
So that did seem kind of odd to me that they would just kind of wait and as long as it did. But
Start listening, and you kind of forget that they're listening. You just get caught up on what Nickabrick is saying. So the issue of calling up the White Witch has been one of those things that's been discussed quite a bit, especially with when the Prince Caspian movie came out. Is could the Hag and the Werewolf, could they actually have prepared the blue fire and called up the White Witch? And personally, I don't think there's any reason given in the book to say they could not have done that. It's possible that they're just making stuff up and they actually couldn't do it. But I think that as far as we can tell from the book, they could have done that, and there's no compelling reason to say they couldn't.
I don't know. I guess I kind of wondered. I'm kind of 50-50 on it. Part of me kind of thinks, you know, she could have come back. I tend to think if Aslan really killed her, that she's dead, they're gone, you know, not going to come back.
That's a fair point. I can understand that. Of course, we don't know how useful the witch's ghost would be.
The offense is they're trying to do it.
Right, absolutely.
You know, it's kind of like you can read the story of the Tower of Babel and wonder, how high could they build that thing? You know, are they actually trying to build it to heaven? You know, but that's in some ways beside the point.
It's the ultimate, you know, we'll forget about Aslan, we're giving up on him.
Exactly.
And you obviously have to admire Truffle Hunter's stubbornness to the very end. You know, we beasts don't change. You know, the help may even be now of the door, which of course it is.
And I love Caspian's meeting with Peter here. It's sort of it's respectful and kind of must have been awe-inspiring for Caspian.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. You know, one of the first things Peter says to him is, I haven't come to take your place, you know, but to put you into it. So Peter certainly has an understanding, I guess, that I'm not going to be here forever, which I would think probably in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, during, you know, after he's been king for a few years, I'm sure he's just thinking, yeah, I guess this is just where I'm going to be. And it must have been a surprise when he got back.
And I like that it also gives a little bit of an urgency to the story because, you know, okay, hey, I'm just here for this.
Right.
You know, I'm not here for us to camp out, hide in the woods, and become Robin Hoods forever. You know, that's not why I'm here. I'm here to give you your throne back. Peter introduces chivalry again, and he's able to kind of present that image of it that Caspian can then look to, and that the other Narnians can then look to. And I just love that. And that's, I think, why, in some ways, you know, I've always been torn. I love the character of Reba Cheep. But then I just love the character of Peter. He's humble, he makes mistakes, and he always owns up to it. He always does a chivalrous thing.
And I think you can see a certain amount of chivalry in the way he writes the letter, even though he's sort of insulting Miraz, when he's addressing Miraz, you know, he says, you know, from Peter, you know, High King of Narnia by election and by conquest, you know, by gift of Aslan, blah, blah, blah. Then he says, to Miraz, son of Caspian VIII, sometime Lord Protector of Narnia, and now styling himself King of Narnia, greeting. And yeah. So it's just
my wife once said this. She was watching a British politician speak, and she said, oh, the British can just, they can say something and sound so polite while they're trashing somebody,
and no one better than High King Peter.
Exactly.
This whole idea of, let's just offer single combat, let's offer to settle this, you know, in a more civilized way, you know, rather than having there be more bloodshed. And that's really, ultimately, Peter doesn't actually assumes Miraz is going to refuse it. It's only Miraz's own pride
that
makes him accept it.